This is the Quiet Innovation Podcast with John Gavin, episode number 13. We are staying on the money trail.
I have got the best idea.
Great idea.
Dude, I got the best idea.
Greatest idea.
I've got a great idea.
Hey everybody, my name is John Gavin. I'd like to welcome you back to this, the Quiet Innovation Podcast, the show that's all about helping you turn your great ideas into reality. Okay, in the last episode, we talked about the fact that you do have a great idea, and in this case, all of your research, all your trusted friends and advisors say you might actually be onto something, but you need money. So, to continue with the theme of helping you learn more about ways you can get money for your great idea, today I'm joined by David S. Rose, founder and CEO of Gust, the global platform for startup funding. And Gust has funded over 1,800 startups in just the past 12 months. David is a technology visionary and investor who has founded or funded over 85 companies. He has a lot you want to hear, and it's all coming up. All right. So I continue to broadcast from what I like to call the Northwoods part of the United States here in Minnesota. But oh, am I frustrated with the geniuses running this state right now. Effective July 1st, they passed this online sales tax. It's part of a big catfight between Target and Best Buy, which are headquartered here, and Amazon. This is a trend that's occurring all across the country. It's about 12 or so states this has occurred. And it is so horrible because Amazon's not paying the tax. They view this thing as unconstitutional. But guess who is paying? People like me, independent bloggers and podcasters, are getting crushed. We're having our contracts, our affiliate contracts. So for example, in my guest interview today with David Rose, he recommends a number of books. In the past, you would have clicked on the link. I would have earned a small commission. That was your way of showing your appreciation and support for the show. Now I won't. Amazon canceled their contract with me. So did some of my other affiliates. And this is just really bad. It's bad. It's bad law. It's bad politics. And it's hurting small businesses. So anyway, I'm a little wound up. I told you that mainly because I want to tell you something else that's a little more positive. Not everyone has canceled my contract, and I have a lot of real high quality affiliates I've now formed relationships with. So as the Quiet Innovation Podcast is maturing, I'm forming relationships with real high quality companies that I've had relationships with in the past. That is, as their customer. So for example, you've heard me talk in the past perhaps about Quicken, a QuickBooks software for accounting, hands down, the accounting software you need if you're serious about bringing credibility and legitimacy to your startup. Well, I set up a resources page called, Help for Your Great Idea. I think that's what I called it. And under that, I've posted all the links for your ability to, that's what it's called, Help for Your Great Idea. You'll see it at quietinnovation.com. And gradually I'm populating it with these different products and services. So I have already all the Intuit products like QuickBooks, and you can get it online, or you can get desktop version. I've used Paychex accounting software in the past. They're not software, they're a service, a Paychex, payroll service. So I have them up there. Basically, the bottom line is there's a lot of things, tools, and services you need to turn your great idea into reality. Well, I've set up a resource for you. And even though I'm caught in this middle, as are a number of podcasters and bloggers, with this stupid online sales tax nonsense that's going on, not everybody has canceled. I still have a number of really high quality affiliate partners. And of course, the way the model works is, if you need one of these products or services, you click on the link, I earn a small commission, you earn my gratitude, the price you pay will be the exact same as if you had gone to the website directly. So with that, our guest today is really awesome. David S. Rose, oh my goodness. So I had the pleasure of actually meeting David when I was at the Venture Forward Conference in New York. You heard me talk about that. That was a few weeks back. And he agreed to come on my show, and he talks about Gust. He talks about all kinds of really cool things related to raising capital, related to getting your new startup funded. And so with that, let's move on ahead. All right, so today our very special guest is a man by the name David S. Rose, and he is the founder and CEO of Gust. I said that at the introduction to today's show. And that's a phenomenal platform for startups, for entrepreneurs and angel investors like me to come together. So what you do is you put your, you know, it's essentially your investor relations platform, and you put your materials up there when you're looking to get capital, and guys like me are able to see what you're doing. And David will talk about the platform because that's one of my very first questions for him. But there's a lot more to David S. Rose than Gust. He's the chairman emeritus of New York Angels, which developed and manages the global collaboration platform for early stage angel investing. And they've connected hundreds of thousands of entrepreneurs and investors in over 75 countries. I mean, this is for real. And David S. Rose is described, catch this, Business Week calls him a world conquering entrepreneur, and Forbes once called him New York's archangel. He truly is a technology visionary and investor who, as I said, has funded or founded over 85 companies. So with that, let's go to the interview now with David Rose. David, I'd like to thank you for joining me today on the Quiet Innovation Podcast. I'm so glad that you could join me and, you know, share your wisdom and your experience with my audience of startups and entrepreneurs.
It's my pleasure. I'm looking forward to it.
And you know what? I can tell that it really is your pleasure because I've seen you speak. I've had the pleasure of meeting you in person. Your energy is phenomenal, and that's why I want to expose you to my audience. And let's start with the basics. So you founded an organization called Gust. What is Gust?
Gust has a very tiny little goal, and that is to create the infrastructure platform for the entire next generation of early stage entrepreneurial finance. So to boil that down.
Well, you did say tiny.
Tiny. And we're talking globally too, right?
True.
To boil that down, it means that in this world of exploding entrepreneurship and at the same time exploding technology and exploding sources of capital, we are building the infrastructure that connects all of them together. So Gust is an online platform that provides tools for all of the various players within the overall entrepreneurial ecosystem to collaborate with each other and get stuff done that they need. So, for example, entrepreneurs use Gust at no cost to put up an entire investor relations website, which has all the information that investors need to look at when they're considering an investment. And it lets them manage their whole process so they can track all of their investors and their interest and pull together their financing round. At the same time, working on the other side of the table, Gust provides a complete tool set for investors, whether individual investors like angels or organized investors like angel groups or institutional investors like venture capital funds or seed funds. It gives them the tools to manage their whole investment process so they can manage their deal flow, companies that are seeking funding, companies that they go out and seek, and the entire process of collaboration with the entrepreneur, collaboration among the investors, due diligence, and the like in order to come to the decision to fund a company. And then after that's all done, Gust provides the ability for both sides to, on an ongoing basis, communicate and collaborate to make sure that everybody is up to speed. And so what we're doing is building this extraordinary platform. We've been working on it for quite a while. It's now used by most of everybody in those classes. It's just going to get bigger and better. The great thing about Gust is that it subscribes to the network effect, which is Metcalfe's law. Bob Metcalfe, the founder of the 3Com, inventor of the Ethernet, came up with Metcalfe's law, which says that the power of a network is equal to the square of the number of nodes on it. So that means the more people you have connected and using a network, the more valuable it is to everybody. And in our particular case right now, we've got something like 200,000 startups who are using Gust to manage their investor relations. And at the same time, we've got nearly 50,000 accredited investors who are using it to manage their investments in their portfolios, as well as over 1,000 organized investment organizations, angel groups and venture capital funds and the like. And when you consider that all of these investors and institutions and entrepreneurs are globally connected, and they're in virtually every country in the world, you can see the power. So today, GUST is the official platform not only for the Angel Capital Association here in the United States, but the equivalent organizations in Canada, the National Angel Capital Organization of Canada, New Zealand, Australia, Ireland, Scotland, Norway, Spain, France, Portugal, Turkey, Russia, Belarus, Kazakhstan, Brazil, China, India, localized into all these languages, connecting entrepreneurs in each region with investors in their regions, but also investors globally. So we are helping to bring together the entire entrepreneurial world.
So if I may, let's stay with the I'm the guy with the great idea. And I'm going to ask you a question later on whether you should even seek capital, but let's assume you are. You want to get some angel investors into your idea. Do you apply to GUST? Do you need a business plan? Start at the very beginning. How does someone with a great idea?
Before we even answer that question, we have to challenge the premise.
Okay.
And the premise is that ideas get funded. Ideas do not get funded.
Ah.
Nobody will fund an idea. Not an angel investor, not a venture capitalist, not a seed fund, not anybody. Because that is probably the single biggest fallacy about what is happening in the early stage space. I actually just wrote a piece for the Wall Street Journal blog today about the difference between ideas and execution. There's a wonderful blog post that I would direct your listeners to by a guy named Derek Sivers, who is a very, very smart guy. And he wrote a blog post, which you can find on his website at sivers.org, sivers.org/multiply, MULTIPLY.
And we'll put that in the show notes so that it'll be
right.
On
there. So what that post shows is the different relative value of ideas and execution. And so the point that he makes are that ideas are simply a multiplier of execution. And so you might scale ideas from, like -1 for a really bad idea to 0 for a worthless idea to, 1, 10, 20, on that kind of scale. But on the other scale, in terms of execution, turning the idea into reality, into a business, you're talking hundreds of thousands, millions, tens of millions. So an idea by itself has no value for the simple reason. First of all, there are a lot more ideas out there than there are viable businesses.
Right, right.
If you just look at the number I just gave you about there are 200,000 startups on GUST now in the business looking for funding for investors. Do you think there are 200,000 separate ideas for businesses?
Yeah, pushing it.
Right. Well, you think there are 20,000 different ideas for businesses? There aren't that many jobs in the overall job classification, right?
Right.
All right. How about 2,000 different ideas? Maybe.
Okay.
Right? So if you grant, with your squinting, that there are maybe 2,000 separate, completely separate ideas out there, and we've got 200,000 companies on GUST looking for funding, that means no matter how unique you think your idea is, there are probably 100 people out there who are also looking for funding for the same idea. So that's why investors don't fund ideas. But what has changed is that this wasn't always the case. It used to be that the only way to turn an idea into reality was to get money and go ahead and build a company, and it was expensive. And so if you had an idea in the 1970s, 60s, and 70s for really interesting stuff, you needed funding. You couldn't fund that out of your pocket, so you had to go to people who were aggregating capital, like venture capitalists.
Right, right.
If you had an idea for a new chip fabrication factory or something, right, it took a lot of money. Now, over the last several years, the cost of starting a company has been dropping like a rock. When I first started my very first internet company, it took something like $20 million in venture capital before we were able to ship our internet product. Now, partially that came because we were just at the beginnings of the internet. But still, $20 million is a lot of money, and there's no way that you could have done that on your own. But then when I came to my second internet company, This time it only took $2 million to get the site programmed and up and operating and getting to shipment of our internet site. And then after I became an angel investor, after the dot-com boom and bust, the first company in which I invested as an angel only took $200,000 in angel investment in order to get to the shipment of its internet product.
Wow.
And that, so that's another order of that's two orders of magnitude in difference.
Right, right.
And then a few years ago, New York Angels, the angel group that I founded here in New York, and I had Brian Cohn on a while ago, who's the current chairman. He succeeded me as chairman. New York Angels invested in a company called Pond5, which is an online marketplace for stock video footage and stock media. When they came to us, they had a fully operating website. They were generating revenue. They had a full management team.
Wow.
And we wrote them a check. When we wrote them a check, the total amount that they had invested to get to that point of a fully operating ship product, $20,000.
Holy cow, that's nothing.
Go, another order of magnitude.
Yeah.
And then these days, if you have an idea for a simple iPhone application or a basic website, content or any other kinds of things using established pieces, you can come up with an idea and you can find a local teenager or a local web shop or somebody online through crowdsourcing who can build your entire site for you for $2,000. That's another order of magnitude. So what you're seeing is the cost of entry into the getting into business game has dropped drastically. And so therefore, the bar has for what it takes has been lowered. And correspondingly, the bar has been raised when it comes to investment, because our assumption is, since we know what these costs are and we know, how straightforward it is to be able to get something started now with all the tools that are available online, all the companies that come to us have traction. They have a company that's been established, a product that's been developed or nearly so. They have, in many cases, customers and traction and proof that they have a functioning company. And so if you're up against those kinds of competitors with only an idea, there's simply no way that any serious investor is going to find you, because why should we take the additional risk? I mean, investing in early stage companies is risky enough as it is. To add on to that, if I got two companies who are doing the same thing and one of them is just an idea and the other one hasn't actually put that idea into practice, every day I'll go with the one that has shown me successful traction.
I am so glad you went down this path, because the tagline to my show is helping you turn your great ideas into reality. And I think my audience gets tired of me. It's almost like I'm preaching at them, where I say, hey, vision's great. It all starts with vision, but vision without execution goes nowhere. There's blocking and tackling. The way I describe it is, imagine you're going overseas to a city you've never been, and it's all exciting to think about it. And I always like to say, let's start with the basics. How do you get from the airport? You have your great idea. What's your version of get from the airport? What are the first things you need to do to make this real?
Absolutely. And the secret here, and that everybody has to understand absolutely, is nobody is going to provide any money or that kind of financial support for you until you've shown that you've taken the first two, three, four, two dozen steps to get something going. And it's not because they're evil, or it's not because your idea isn't great. It's because it is now so straightforward and so basic to get a company started. And we are in such a globalized world that there are people just like you in Kazakhstan and Bangalore and Norway and Brazil, who are all working on similar kinds of things, who can all reach out to a similar market through the internet that you're reaching out, who can all access the same kinds of cloud hosting services that you can. And they have a lot of energy and they are going ahead and just doing it. And so if you're sitting back waiting for somebody to come along and put cash in your pocket to go pay for all this stuff so you don't have to take any risk, not going to work.
So one of my listeners, his name is Elijah, and he was asking me, when does he know that he has something real? He's doing some kind of a startup thing, software thing. And does he invest his own money and time to create that first prototype? Does he need to show revenue? How do you know?
So the answer to your first question is yes, you invest your own money and time to create the prototype. So, and you invest your own time. Nobody, unless you get out of bed, nobody's going to come near you, right? And then unless you have put your own money into getting something going, nobody else is going to invest. If you're not prepared to take a risk of your own capital, why on earth would anybody else? And that's one thing, you know, very often, you know, there's a wonderful New Yorker cartoon which shows a couple of entrepreneurs approaching a venture capitalist and saying, we've put our heart and soul into this company. All we're asking from you is $10 million. So unfortunately, we don't in the real world judge heart and soul on quite the same level as fungible cash. Fungible means that it can be traded indistinguishably for something else. And so the $10 million that you're looking for investment in your company can be used to invest in another company, can be used to buy a Maserati, can be used to take a round-the-world trip, for a couple of years. And whereas the work you're putting into your company, that's dedicated to your company. So you had better put that in first before you're asking somebody else to decide to put capital, which could go anywhere, into your company. And the nice thing about this is that you can get things started today, unless you're talking about drug discovery or, you know, heavy hardware, chip fabrication kind of stuff, or building a nuclear power plant. You can get a whole lot of stuff built and developed really, really inexpensively using all the things that are now available in the cloud, online tools, crowdsourcing, and other kinds of things.
So I'm going to pick the person who has the great idea but no track record. And I'm going to use what I like to call the B&B analogy, which is, gee, honey, wouldn't it be great to just run our own little B&B in New England? It would be great. And whenever I hear people say that to me, I say, no, it's great to you as a guest because it sounds wonderful. But you need to think of what it's really like to run a business. How are you going to do this? You might not like it. What advice do you give to someone to sort of test drive their conviction first? And I want to keep moving down the progression. You pass the test drive in each of the sequential steps.
Right. Okay. Well, first of all, you've just identified two different problems over here.
Okay.
And so when we look at an entrepreneur who's coming to pitch us, we have a sort of mental checklist that we go down to say, is this the kind of person in whom I want to invest? And investing in that person is exactly what we do. We call it betting the jockey, not the horse. It is critically important for us to know who it is we're investing in, because we're not investing in a finished product. We're not investing in a company that's up and operating and generating profitable revenue. We're investing in a vision, in a future. We're taking a major league bet here that you, the entrepreneur, will be able to deliver. And so therefore, we have a whole checklist and we say, is this the person? Put aside all the other things we look for. Is it a large and growing market? Does the business model make sense? Is this scalable?
Right, right, right.
All kinds of things like that. We look first and foremost at you, the entrepreneur. And if you've either seen my TED Talk video on how to pitch a VC, or if somebody has been through some of my presentation training skills, you'll see that the 10 things that the investors look for, first and foremost, is integrity. Right. I should put that up here on the table out front right now before anything else. Integrity is absolutely critical. Integrity is more important than an idea. It's more important than passion. It's more important than market. Because if an investor gets the slightest whiff of anything that is not of impeccable integrity, they're going to walk away. Because there are just so many risks inherent in this startup world that the last thing you want to do is go into it with one hand tied behind your back because you can't trust your partner, right?
Yep.
So the first thing we look for is integrity, and then the second thing we look for is passion, because you have to have passion. It's got to drive everything you do. This is a crazy business. If you're an entrepreneur, by definition, you're crazy. There are no sane entrepreneurs, because by definition, you see something that doesn't exist. You're creating something new, right? That's what a visionary entrepreneur does.
You're seeing things.
You're seeing things. I mean, you're seeing the future. If it already existed, there wouldn't be need for an entrepreneur. So second thing is passion. And then immediately after that come all the things you're asking about now, and that's the experience.
Yep.
But there are really three different kinds of experience, and it's important to separate them out and understand why they're each important and what we look for in them, right? The first kind of experience is the first thing you mentioned, which is starting a business. This is experience in doing a startup. Have you ever created and managed and run a business before? Okay. Now, in the same way that every book is first published in a first edition, there's no such thing as a book that didn't have a first edition, right?
Right.
Now, it may not have a second edition, but every book, every one of the deck of millions of books ever written has had a first edition. By the same token, every single entrepreneur at one point was a first-time entrepreneur. Even no matter how many, I don't care if you're Richard Branson or Steve Jobs, you were at the first time and first-time entrepreneur. So we don't really hold that against an entrepreneur, since everybody was. On the other hand, experience has shown that if you have been through it once, it makes you a better entrepreneur. There is actually a direct correlation that's been shown in a number of studies that if you had a successful first entrepreneurial endeavor, you are more likely than average to have a successful second entrepreneurial endeavor. What so if that's you, really good.
I want to disrupt your track. What if you failed?
Aha! That's where it gets fascinating. If you failed in your first entrepreneurial endeavor, it does not track to your likelihood of success in their second endeavor. Isn't that fascinating? So if you succeed, that gives you a leg up because you are more likely to succeed the second time. But if you fail, it doesn't indicate you're more likely to fail. So therefore, therefore, experience of any kind, success or failure, is a good thing. And that's why investors like to look and invest in serial entrepreneurs who've done it before, because you've got the learning that can only be done with a hands-on experience in creating a business.
Right.
And so whether the business succeeded or failed, there's stuff you just have to learn about how to get a business started, how to build a team, how to raise some money, how to set up all the blocking and tackling, as you call it, to get the business going, right? And then you can learn some of it in business school, some of it from books, some of it from accelerators or mentors, but ultimately it comes down to hands-on experience. So that's the first kind of experience we look for.
Yep.
But note that that is separate from whatever you're doing. That's how to start a business. But the second kind of experience is what we call domain expertise, right? And that's gets to your bed and breakfast kind of thing. So if you're starting a B&B because you love staying in a B&B as a tourist when you visited New England, that's wonderful. But have you ever actually had any experience in running an inn, running a hotel, you know, dealing with customers? And the answer is probably not. So boy, I'm going to be very reluctant to get into your invest in your business as opposed to somebody who has done three of them before or used to run a motel or, you know, a boarding house or a college dorm or something. Anything that gave you domain expertise in that space. So that's the second kind of experience we look for, which is very distinct from the first one. The first one is how to start a business of any kind. And that's a great thing. In New York, we have something called the New York Tech Meetup, which is the community group of many of the startup people in New York City. Right now, there are about 34,000 members, believe it or not.
Holy cow.
It's actually the largest meetup. People have heard of the meetup.com platform, which lets people go online to get offline groups going. The New York Tech Meetup is by far the largest meetup on the entire meetup.com platform. And it's here in New York. I'm actually on the board of directors of the meetup. And when we were hiring for an executive director to come and manage the organization on a day-to-day basis, because it had scaled of that size, we got a resume from a woman who said, I've had 5 years of organizing 2,000 entrepreneurs, and I've got the perfect background for this kind of position. Well, it turned out that the 2,000 entrepreneurs she had been working with were Girl Scouts and brownies who were selling cookies. And it turned out that was – and she had – it was such a spectacular resume. We hired her on the spot. Her name is Jessica Lawrence, and we have never looked back. She's been spectacular. And I tell you, running Girl Scouts in California, because she just moved to New York, was the perfect background for managing all of these crazy entrepreneurs. And that's the kind of experience we look for in starting and managing and running an operation. It's directly analogous. So she hadn't worked with high-tech entrepreneurs in New York, but helping all of these ambitious young people turned out to have a lot of correlation. So the first thing is experience in starting up. Second thing is experience in the domain in which you're operating, whether it's a bread and breakfast or selling shoes or whatever. And then the third kind of experience are the individual skills that are required to run a company. And this is whether it's if you're doing a website, it's programming, if it's selling shoes and being able to find suppliers, merchandising, and so on and so forth. It's the financial skills of running a business. It is the all the various pieces, sales and marketing, HR and so on. And so not everybody has all those skills, even people like me. and so therefore, the next thing after that we look for is leadership, because if you don't have those skills, you've got to show us or convince us at least that you'll be able to bring other people onto your team who will be able to fill in those things. So if you're trying to create a website or a social network and you've never programmed a computer, you have no idea how to program a social network, it's going to be hard for us to invest in you, obviously, until you can demonstrate that you've actually got those kinds of skills.
One of the things I did in running my company was, so my background was as a Wall Street analyst, and I created this publishing company to produce investment research independently. And I was good at it, but I hated to do it at scale. So I hired somebody who was a better analyst than I am. And how many entrepreneurs do you see have that ability at the startup stage to put together a team of people smarter than they are? How many can...
That is one of the secrets of the startup world. And there's a great book, a very short book called Lucky or Smart by Bo Peabody. And it's about 50 or 75 pages. It's a little paperback. You can get it on Amazon. Highly recommended. You might want to put a link in the show notes there as well. And one of his major points is, the first thing you do is hire the smartest people you can. You try and hire everybody who is smarter and better than you at whatever you're doing. Entrepreneurs who think that they are God's gift to humanity and only hire people who are weaker than they are the ones who are doomed. If you hire an A player, A players hire A players, B players hire C players, and that's where companies begin to diverge. So it's you can't always find them, but if you find them, do not be afraid to hire somebody who is smarter than you are.
Our whole culture was about hiring A players because of what you just said. The one A player can replace the work of a handful of B and certainly C players. And
without question.
Yeah. And as me, as the leader, as the entrepreneur, I just didn't have time to be the expert in all the stuff that I hired people to be the expert for. And so I want to go back to the one of the number one things you assess for, which is integrity. And I'm going to ask you for a couple ways you assess it. But first, I'm going to bait you a little bit with a couple words. Are you ready? This idea is truly unique. Our idea is revolutionary. Go with it.
Well, that has
was that to too easy? Integrity. Was that too easy?
But that has little to do with integrity, but that has to do with on the one hand being unrealistic,
okay,
and on the second hand stating claims you can't back up, right? So as we said in the opening of the show, to think that any idea is unique is almost certainly a fallacy. Right. And I don't care what it is, given the fact that there are 6 or 7 billion people in the world, somebody somewhere has likely had that idea before. And it's not like Jeff Bezos was the first person to think about online commerce.
Right.
And so this comes back to execution. And so, any claim you make, any absolute, every time anybody says any kind of absolute, that is an immediate sign that I should head for the hills. We're unique. We're the best. We are the whatever it is. Unless you can immediately back up that statement with facts. Right?
Perfect. Because I always do that. It's like, oh, really? Tell me how you got there. And then that's part of my integrity test, because now if you start throwing fluff at me and opinion and all that, you're discrediting yourself so fast.
Absolutely. But and so in terms of other keys to integrity, how you talk about your former employers, your partners, how you discuss your customers, what the business model is. I mean, is it a business model that's based on breakage, as we say, which like a gift card where people pay for it and then don't use it, and so you make money on what they leave behind? Must be in that business, right? That's not. I mean, it's not fundamentally creating value. It's fundamentally being a sort of icky business. And that's why, all of the various states' attorney generals have outlawed those kinds of businesses and so on and so forth, right? So in everything you say and in everything you do and how you describe your customers, your partners, and your colleagues, your employees, your former investors, all that goes into how we look at you. And anything that in any way gives us pause for thought is effectively a deal killer.
Sure. Sure. What are some other ways? I guess because it's hard. I almost invested in a company, a medical device company out here in Minnesota, and only in my own due diligence process did I realize they were lying to me about who owned the IP. But up until then, everything looked great. It felt good.
Well, but the minute you got that, I mean, this is really a Manichaean, good or bad, good kind of, right? It's totally binary. The minute you catch somebody in any kind of untruth, and in my case, I don't care how big or how little an untruth it is. If it is the smallest, teeniest, tiniest thing, including where you had breakfast today, that's gonna kill you. I mean, literally, you're dead. If I catch you in any untruth, the conversation is over. I may be polite enough to listen and let you finish your, you know, 20-minute pitch, but there's no chance at all of investment.
All right. I want you to help me reconcile that then with some guidance I got in the past. And I went against that guidance. One of the bankers I got to know said, you know, John, your business plan really needs to show a hockey stick of revenue and blah, blah, blah. And I mean, my whole background as an analyst was I can't defend it. It's really promising and then it gets really good. But I'm not going to put numbers into my business plan that I can't defend.
Not absolutely, but there are two different questions here, right?
Yeah.
One question, he's saying it's not that your business plan has to show this. Okay, it doesn't. If the business can't support it, it doesn't have to show it. What he is saying is that investors are not able to invest in businesses that don't show that kind of thing. So that sounds like it's saying the same thing, but it's not. There's a really serious difference there, right? One's on the buy side, one's on the sell side. I mean, as an entrepreneur, I have to do the best job I can at giving the clear. I can be optimistic, but it's got to be realistic. I have to believe what I'm selling. If you ever try and pitch me something that you don't believe, that's one of the first signs of a lack of integrity.
Right.
Because I'll be able to tell. I'll be able to tell the minute you open your mouth, right? If you're trying to tell me something that you don't believe yourself, and that's one of the things that is a hallmark of integrity. On the other hand, as an investor, the kinds of businesses, the only businesses that make sense for me to invest in as an angel are businesses where I can legitimately see a way to getting 30 times my money back over, you know, 5, 6, 7, 8 years.
Right.
That sounds insanely tough for an entrepreneur. And you know what? It is insanely tough. But that's how this business works, because the bottom line is that, you know, half of all the companies I invest in, no matter how wonderful the entrepreneur, how great the business model, how large the market, over half of all the businesses in which I invest go bankrupt totally, completely, taking all the money away. And so that means that, you know, for the 1 out of 10 that it actually hits that 30x, 30 times result for me, that's what makes my investment across the entire portfolio work. And so therefore, if 1 in 10 is going to make the portfolio work, all 10 in which I invest have to at least have the potential of, if things work out, returning 30x. And so that's why investors need to invest only in businesses that are potentially really, really high growth. And therefore, why not all businesses, even really good businesses, are simply not appropriate for an outside equity investment. So, for example, if you're talking about a Main Street hardware store or something, right? It may be a perfectly viable, there may be a need for the hardware store in the community, it may be a perfectly viable business. It may pay you a very nice salary and support you and your family, put your kids through college, provide enough money for your retirement. That's wonderful. It's what's technically in the trade we call a lifestyle business, but there's nothing at all wrong with a lifestyle business. However, that's not fundable by outside equity. Right. So there's no way that an outside investor can get enough of a return over time to make that investment make sense. So that's the kind of business that you would have to pull together your own capital or maybe some friends and family capital to buy your initial stock. And then, you know, once you have that, you've got a lease and you've got the store, maybe you go to the local bank who will advance money on your either, you know, backed up by your stock or based on your sales, and you slowly build it up. And that could be a perfectly viable business, just not one that is in the right place for angel or venture financing.
Let's stay in that space for just a second. It is going to be the hardware store or something, and maybe you can structure some kind of debt or something where the bondholder will get a 12% return. You know, I mean, that's a really nice return for some people. Is there a place that startups can go get that kind of capital aside from the bank? And if so, where do they find it?
Well, it's really challenging. You, I'm sure, know about the whole crowdfunding revolution that is in the process of taking place. And I say in the process because it hasn't taken place yet. The only kind of crowdfunding that is legal now in the United States is a creative project crowdfunding, non-equity-based crowdfunding, things like Kickstarter, which say that, hey, you put up an idea, here's my idea, or here's the project I want to do, and people give you money. And they either give you money because they like what you're doing, or they give you money in exchange for your promise to give them a product once you develop it, right? That's legal today. Getting people to give you money for a share in your business is not legal today. That's called equity crowdfunding. and it's not legal for any unaccredited investor to do. One of the things that defines an angel investor in the United States today and in many other countries is that they're what the SEC, Securities and Exchange Commission, considers to be an accredited investor. And the rules for that in the U.S. are that you have to have either over $1 million in investable assets, not including your primary residence, or you have to have at least $200,000 a year in income for the past couple of years and a reasonable expectation of the same going forward, or alternatively, $300,000 if you're combining it with your spouse and you file jointly. So either you're making a lot of money or you have a lot of money in the bank. And the reason the SEC put those requirements out is investing in private companies, these startup early stage private companies, is really, really, really risky. As I said, the majority of them go completely under and lose all the money. And so the SEC wants to know that if you're actually investing in this in these crazy businesses, you can afford to totally lose your entire investment. So that's part of the challenge. But in the crowdfunding, on the other hand, they just passed these regulations under the Jobs Act of 2012 last year that will, for the first time, allow people who are not accredited investors to invest in private companies under very defined circumstances. And right now, the regulations haven't been written for that, so it's not yet, as of July 2013, legally possible to do that. But everybody hopes that by the end of this year, maybe, those rules will be out. And that's where people are beginning to think about the kind of stuff you're talking about. So we at Gust have actually been trying to help the crowdfunding world by drafting some sample investment documents that provide for exactly what you're talking about. They provides a way to invest, to put money behind a venture that may not be a mega high growth thing, but in a structure that will actually work. And so what we've suggested is companies that are considering raising money from the crowd, from unaccredited investors, take the money in the form of what's called a revenue-backed loan or revenue-backed note. So let's say a company raises $10,000. Let's say you want to raise $10,000 to buy the initial stock for your hardware store, right?
Yep.
You put out your campaign online, and investors or your supporters effectively loan you that $10,000. And the terms are, you get that money, but the minute you start making any kind of revenue, not profit, right? The minute you start getting revenue in the door by selling whatever you're selling, right? You begin to pay back that that loan, say, 5% of your revenues. So if you're talking about, 5% of revenues, that's a fairly big chunk of change. It would certainly eat into your profits, but it's not so much that it will kill the company, right?
Right.
And so if you take 5% of every dollar that comes in the door, gross dollars that come in the door, your sale price, and you begin to pay back that investment, that $10,000 you got, and you can keep paying it out of 5% of your gross receipts until you've paid all that cash back, right? At that point, your investors or your sponsors or lenders or however you want to describe them gave you the cash. They've gotten their, in a short period of time, they've gotten their bait back. So they're now at least secure that they're not going to lose money on you. And then once they get paid back, then that rate drops, say, from 5% to 2.5% or something. Right?
Yep.
And so now you are effectively providing 2.5% of your revenue, or you can think of it as a royalty if you've got a profit or if you've got a product or whatever. And that 2.5% keeps getting paid to your investors now who have already been made whole until they have gotten something like, five times their money back, made a 500% return.
Uh-huh.
Okay, well, that'd be pretty cool. And then at that point, then it's over. Then you're finished. They're finished with you. You're finished with them, and you're totally clean. So if you do it that way, they're betting that the business will at least succeed to be able to generate some revenue so they can get their bait back. They're hoping that you'll be able to make an ongoing business so they can make money over time. And if they actually can get, 500% return over some whatever is not a year, 2 years, 3 years, that's an amazing return. They can't get anywhere else, right? So they're really taking the high reward there. On the other hand, the fact that it's not stock – in the company. Mm-hmm. And the fact that it's a loan makes it much easier to handle. And it also means that if the company later on finds another, you know, a larger investor, an angel or a venture capitalist or something else who wants to actually buy a piece of the company, and it's problematic to have these other little investors or funders out there, they can, in theory, be paid off at the full five times their investment, right?
Right.
In which case, everybody's happy. The company has a clean, you know, capitalization table. The new investors are happy, and it all works. So I think you'll be seeing a fair amount of things like this, revenue-backed notes, in the sort of very early stage, non-accredited investor equity crowdfunding space, because it makes sense for the borrower and the lender.
I really, you know, that concept as you're laying it out, it's really fascinating because there's not that leaching of valuation because there's a terminal point. It's
right, you know. And part of the problem with valuation, as your listeners probably know, when an investor, an angel or VC makes an equity investment, buys stock in a company, there is a math formula that says how much of ownership of the company am I getting based on how much money I'm putting in, and that ultimately translates to answer the question: how much is this company worth before I invest my money? In our business, we call it that's the pre-money valuation. And so determining what the pre-money valuation is of a company that doesn't even have, that has no profits, no revenues yet, may not even have a finished product yet. I mean, that's not a science. That's not even art. That's almost sticking your finger up in the wind and saying, okay, give me a number. And so the odds of any first-time entrepreneur or any casual friend and family investor being able to get that number even close to accurate is almost impossible. It's difficult for angels even.
Sorry, I didn't mean to.
No, it's okay.
When would you recommend that a startup actually seek capital, and when should they avoid it?
Well, it really is tough getting raising capital. I mean, people, you know, if all you do is look at the tabloid newspapers and read TechCrunch and the blogs and so on, it seems that every kid in Silicon Valley who's got some wackadoodle idea sticks his hand out, and the next thing you know, he's being showered with $100 million in cash. That just doesn't happen. That's not the real world. In the real world, the odds of getting money, an investment from an angel investor, are 40 to 1. That means for every 40 aspiring entrepreneurs with an idea, a really good idea, and a product vision, only one of them is going to be able to make it, and 39 are not. And if you think that's bad, when it comes time to raising money from venture capitalists, the odds are 400 to 1.
What are the odds of getting money from a public company?
That's a strategic investor.
Yeah.
And those typically are right up there with the sort of VC levels.
Yeah.
Because, you know, in theory, VCs and angels are to a large extent investing in anything that will make money, provided it's in a general area, right? Whereas strategic investors, public companies, and I know you got some in your case from public company, but that was, that's a relatively unusual thing.
It was.
You have to be able to match exactly what this particular company needs with your precise product or the service that you're providing. And that's not true for most people with startups.
And my experience up until that point was consistent with what you just said. The door was slammed in my face over and over. It's just how it works when you're trying to pitch your idea.
You know, and society is partly at fault for this because, you know, if you listen to the blogosphere or read these things or you look at the amazing stories of Donald Trump or Richard Branson or whatever it is, it seems that everybody out there has got a good idea. They work hard and they get lots of money and they make $1 billion.
Right.
You know, the Mark Zuckerberg, you look, watch The Social Network and say, it doesn't work that way. For every movie like this, you watch like The Social Network, showing Zuckerberg making billions of dollars in value. There's another movie called Startup.com. You also want to link to that one on the show.
Yep, notes. I will.
And that shows that traces a real live startup in real time, cinema verite, during the dot-com boom in New York. As the company goes out and is formed, you see the co-founders and they're working in their apartments. One of them leaves his job and they get going, and then they go out and they raise money from investors. And it's really tracking them. So it was one of the very first reality series, as it were. It was a reality movie about startups. And, you know, eventually they ended up getting wiped out pretty much in the crash. And that's a much more typical scenario than the Zuckerberg making $1 billion. And people don't understand that. And yes, as you found, you've got to go knock on door after door after door door after door after door before anybody will give you the time of day. And that's true for sophisticated entrepreneurs, serial entrepreneurs. I mean, unless you're the kind of person with a track record, you know, I mean, Steve Jobs or Bill Gates could go out and raise money. Not a problem.
Right.
But for anybody else out there, unless you've got, you know, a rock solid reputation as a rock star entrepreneur, which, you know, 0.001% of the world is. For everybody else, it's a long, tough slog, and you better be prepared to spend 6, 9, 12 months knocking on doors looking for an investment. And I will tell you, you know, and then the bare, bald facts of the matter are that if you have spent 12 months, you're really shaking every tree you can, talking to angels, talking to companies, talking to your local angel groups and accelerators and incubators and economic development agencies and seed funds and going online and using platforms like Gust and the like. And after 12 months, you don't have any nibbles from investors on there. That's the market sending you a very clear signal that you may or may not have a good idea or even a great idea, but that what you have is actually not going to be the kind of thing that would be investable by an equity investor.
And let's stay with that for a minute, because that's exactly where I wanted to go. And I'm watching the clock too. We're heading toward the end, and I want to use up the last amount of time as prudently as I can. Let's stay in the space of, you know, maybe this isn't going to work. What are some of the signs? Like, you just gave a great one. Hey, you banged on a lot of doors for a year and you're still getting told no. What are some of the other signs?
Well, the ultimate sign is no traction. If you've been doing something for a year and you haven't got anybody to buy it, that's a real indication from the market that you may have a challenge. These days, there is a new approach called the Lean Startup Methodology. There's a book by Eric Ries, R-I-E-S, called The Lean Startup, which you should also link to.
Yep, I will.
Which walks you through the whole process of starting a company, figuring out what company you're going to start. And this is based on the work of Eric Ries and Steve Blank and others at Stanford and a sort of growing movement around the world, which says you want to do customer-centered development. Start off, so the very first thing you do is see, are there any customers out there who are the least bit interested in what you're doing?
Got it.
And one way to approach this is to just put up, if you're doing something on the web, put up a landing page and then take out a couple of ads. You know, pay Google, you know, a few dollars to put up, you know, AdWords out there, which will appear on, you know, highlighted search terms, and say, you know, I'm selling X. And see if anybody clicks on it. If you take out a bunch of ads and you say, here's this really great X, and nobody wants to, you know,
nobody cares.
Searching for X, nobody cares. That's a hint that maybe you shouldn't go do X, right? And on the other hand, if you put up saying we're doing X, and then you get 1,000 people, you know, in the first day clicking over to your site saying, where's X? Where's X? You know, and you can have a single page saying, you know, X coming soon. But at that point, you will at least have figured out that there are 1,000 people. There's a market demand for X. And so then, you know, hey, okay, now I'll take the next step, which is to go build X, right?
Yep.
So that kind of testing and customer validation is the way to start going, and then constantly iterating and pivoting and changing and listening to your customers and modifying what you're doing and ultimately building something that your customers want. And that's the best way to get traction and the best way to develop a business that makes sense and ultimately the best way to get funding.
You know, you're reflecting a theme that pretty much all my guests recently have said, which is do something. Do something to get a feedback loop going. Get some kind of something out there that people can react to, and then you can get a sense. What about mortgaging your life? Why not? So,
you know, this is one of those things about which everybody is ambivalent. On the one hand, we say that investors aren't going to put the first money into a company, that you have to get started on your own. You've got to develop traction. You know, we invest in execution, not ideas.
Yep.
And so the question is, how then do you execute? On the other hand, you know, it's really painful. I mean, one of the most painful things to see is an entrepreneur who's mortgaged his house, maxed out on his credit cards, you know, taken his wife's and his mother's money and his Aunt Edna's life's savings
right.
and put it into this business, and you know this business isn't going to work. I mean, at that point, you just want to sit down and cry. I mean,
sure.
You know, we're investors aren't philanthropists. We're not charities.
Right.
The goal of an investor is not to dig you out of a hole. The goal of an investor is to put in money to make money, ultimately. So. On the other hand, if you're asking me to put money to fund your idea, but you have not been willing to fund your idea yourself, that's an immediate kiss of death, because if you don't have faith in you, why should I have faith in you? So the answer here, you know, is to thread a very, very fine line. And so the amount of money that you should be putting into starting up your company is something that needs to be meaningful to you.
Right.
But at the same time, not so much that it's your entire life savings, right? You're a person, first of all. You have a family. You've got kids. You've got a spouse. You need to plan for your future and your health and so on.
Right.
Every entrepreneur, by definition, thinks his or her idea is the world's ultimate be-all and end-all, most brilliant thing. And in reality, not everybody can have that idea. So therefore, as investors, we want to see that you have devoted real hard, fungible cash into this business, cash that you might otherwise have used to take a vacation or buy a pretty dress or
car,
a new set of tools for your car or whatever, right? And so instead, you're willing to bet that on yourself. And for investors, it's much less important how much that actual money is than it is meaningful to you. And so the goal is, do not spend your entire, future savings and your kids' college money on your idea, no matter how great you think it is. But be prepared to put something in out of your pocket that's going to hurt.
I use the language, where's your firewall? And before I got funded from the public company, I lent my company hundreds of thousands of dollars. But my firewall was I would never violate my home, and I had to have a core amount of savings I wouldn't violate. And
yep.
That gave me peace of mind that if this failed, because odds are stuff fails. It just
does.
That's
right.
So, all right. So let's do some happy talk then. it seems that so many of the ideas that get funded are in the sexy areas of tech and things like that. Where do you see opportunity today?
Well, it's not a question of sexy and it's not a question of tech. So let's go back and analyze why are these internet-based things, which is what we're talking about, getting funded. And this gets back to what we look for in a business. And one of the things we look for is it scalable? And scalability is really critical when investors look at companies. And scalability means you can start something very small out of your own pocket and then using my smallish angel investing dollars to do and prove that it works. And then once you've taken that risky capital, yours and then mine, and established a business that works, and you can prove that for every dollar you put into AdWords or marketing or product development, you can turn around and get $2 in revenue in the door. Once you've gotten to that point, then it can scale up really. All you got to do is put more cash out, put more $1 in, and you get more $2 back. Put more hundreds in, and you get 200s back.
Magic.
And it's magic. And so that's why investors love businesses that can be started very, very small and yet can grow very, very big without requiring. So for that's another reason why consulting businesses very rarely get funded.
Oh, they're terrible business models.
Well, it's not that they're terrible business models. It could be a great business model for the consultant.
Right.
It is a lifestyle business.
Right, right.
If you're a consultant, you can make very nice money advising people on doing things. But in order to scale a business, you'd have to clone yourself, and
right.
That's really expensive.
Right.
So therefore, the kinds of businesses that are invested in are scalable. And what's the best way to scale a business? Well, the best way to scale a business is to use a platform of some kind where you can reach an almost infinitely large number of customers, where you can develop, ways to get out there and get their money in. And the best way to do that is the internet. Right, so if Facebook's got 1 billion users out there, there's no way you can get a billion users in Peoria or Armonk. If you were doing a locally based thing, or if you have to sell a piece of hardware, sure you may be able to sell millions or tens of millions or hundreds of millions of Snuggies or something.
Sure,
but that's the exception rather than the rule. So therefore, what makes these quote sexy unquote businesses fundable, makes these internet business fundable, is that they are all inherently, at least theoretically, scalable. So they can start very small, prove out the model, and then get to be very, very big.
Is there an opportunity for anyone who actually makes physical things?
Sure, there is. I mean, there are lots of physical products, but again, it comes down to how scalable is it? You have to be able to manufacture really cheaply. You have to be able to get to your customers really inexpensively, ship it logistically, get it out there. What are the channels? So you know, there's not a bias against physical things. The bias is, you know, if you're going to do a physical thing, show me, you know, how you reach your customers, who your customers are, how the economics work. Right. And since it's a whole lot cheaper to ship a bit than it is to ship a box, if you can show me that, you know, if you want to sell a digital book on Amazon, the cost for shipping a digital book is one heck of a lot less than shipping a hardcover, right?
David, I think you can tell by this interview, I could ask you questions forever, but I'm not going to do that. And one of the things I loved about what you did with my questions was you ran with them in ways that went far more, you enhanced my own questions. So I really like that you did that. Thank you for that. But now I am going to head to the final question, if I may. Mm-hmm. And my final question in all the interviews I ask is, what's the one piece of advice you would offer to a startup or entrepreneur hoping to turn their own great idea into reality?
Now, unfortunately, here I'm going to be really boring and I'm going to be unoriginal and I'm going to say what every other one of your guests has said, and that is just get off your rear end and
do something.
Do something. Because you can sit in the harbor with your sails furled and nothing is going to happen. And if you do something, you may lose, you may win, but nothing ventured, nothing gained. And the most important thing is to get started. And then if you do it right, you learn and you adapt to what the market tells you is happening, and you pivot and you change and you morph and you iterate and you use customer-centered development, but get something started. That's the first thing you can do.
You know, it's people have heard me say this before in earlier episodes. If you go to the quietinnovation.com website, it's not a fancy site. But my version of do something was I needed to get content with guys like you. That's what I needed to get started. The fanciness and all that can come later. But if I don't have something to give you when you get here, what's the point? So yeah, do something. I love that piece of advice. I promised you that was the last question, so I need to stick to that. You've been most generous with your time and your thoughts. And again, I just love how you ran with my questions. And I would love to have you on the show again sometime in the future if you'd consider doing that.
My pleasure. Look forward to it. Absolutely. Thanks a lot.
All right. Thanks so much. Wow, that was a really good interview. I really liked it. I think that we got a lot from David joining us on the Quiet Innovation Podcast today. And think about it. I mean, you learned, you know, he talked about the fact that it's so much easier. The bar for starting a company today has been lowered. And yet, curiously, the bar for raising capital has actually been raised. And he talked about the key factors that investors do look for in entrepreneurs and startups, the importance of taking a risk with your own money, your own idea, before you go asking for capital from someone else. He offered solutions for problems that most entrepreneurs face, and he gave you the secret behind some of the most successful entrepreneurs, and he even shared what he views as absolute deal killers. So I thought that was a really great okay, let me put it this way. I'm a professional investor, have been my entire career. Yes, I'm an entrepreneur, innovator. Yes, I've raised money, blah, 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 blah. But even I was just sucking in the information from David. He was just that rich with great, great content. I really hope you felt the same way, because that's what it is about here at the Quiet Innovation Podcast. I want to connect you with people like me, who've been there, made a difference, maybe even failed at times in their own versions of innovation, because you've heard me say it many times before, we are the quiet innovators. We're that rare breed who truly has the ability to change the world, to bring positive impact to the lives of others. I mean, think about that. That's just really cool to be able to do that. So as we head home, all right, bringing the show home today, I need to ask a favor of you. In addition to asking you to now give active consideration to supporting my sponsors, I want to ask you if you would take a moment, and maybe when you're done listening to this, you can click on iTunes, the iTunes store, or maybe when you get back to your desk or even sitting in, you know, the cab on your smartphone, can you take a moment and go to iTunes and give me a rating for the Quiet Innovation Podcast? It really makes a difference, and I'm seeing myself slowly move up in the ratings, and you know, that's the type of stuff that can really help. And so if you would do that, I'd really appreciate that. As always, I invite you to go to quietinnovation.com to learn more and leave your feedback. All the social media links that I'm currently using are there. which includes Twitter at Quiet Innovation if you do want to follow me. And there's a phone number. Have you ever thought of calling me and maybe asking a question? Is there a show theme you'd like me to talk about? Maybe I'll even feature your question on a future episode. I'm starting to get some feedback that's actually given me some good direction. You actually heard in my interview with David, I asked a question that came in from a guy named Elijah. So let's see what else. I think I pretty much covered everything on that. The only thing I will say is, like I always say, let's stay fired up about turning your great ideas into reality. And I'm going to do my part to calm down about the idiots running the state of Minnesota. Because actually, in the main, they do a good job. And it's a great place to live. You all have a great weekend or great week or whatever.